If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Seth Meyers here. Welcome to another episode of Late Night Lit, our podcast celebrating books and authors. To discuss what's happening in the world of books, I'm going to turn things over to Sarah Jenks Daly, a supervising producer at Late Night, whose literature expertise is invaluable for myself and for our show. Take it away, Sarah.
Hi everyone, I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, supervising producer at Late Night. This month on Late Night Lit, we are joined by Rebecca Mackay, whose riveting new novel, I Have Some Questions For You, was published in February. We also speak to Nick Higgins, chief librarian at Brooklyn Public Library, who spearheaded Books Unbanned, a new initiative created in response to the growing efforts to censor and remove books from library shelves across the country. Lastly, we'll share a book recommendation from Late Night staffer Kristen Milburn. Rebecca Mackay is an award-winning author well known for her previous books, such as The Hundred-Year House, The Borrower, and The Great Believers, which was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. Her new novel, I Have Some Questions For You, is a provocative and thoughtful story about a professor and podcaster named Bodhi, who accepts a teaching position at her former high school, a prestigious boarding school in New Hampshire. While back on campus, Bodhi begins to reconsider the events surrounding the murder of her former roommate, which occurred decades earlier. Rebecca speaks to us about her interest in crafting a story where perspectives can shift over the passage of time, the research that led her to learning about the New Hampshire legal and correctional systems, and the inevitability, for her, of writing a novel set at a boarding school. Here's my chat with Rebecca. Rebecca Mackay was a guest on Late Night with Seth Meyers in 2018 to talk about her incredible novel, The Great Believers. Her new novel, I Have Some Questions For You, was published in February, and I read it in one weekend. So I'm extremely excited to have the opportunity to talk to her about it today. Rebecca, welcome to Late Night Lit.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on this novel. I burned right through it, as I mentioned. It's very different from The Great Believers, which was the last one I read of yours, which, for those who haven't read it, was a fantastic story centered around a group of gay men living through the beginning of the AIDS epidemic in the mid-80s in Chicago. But I'm always so impressed with how well you're able to build worlds and characters that we as readers are immediately drawn into. And I just wanted to say I thought this novel did a wonderful job of that, too.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, none of my books really have much to do with each other. I'm always changing topic wildly. You can find some themes or ruts or whatever you want to call them, like things that I go back over. But I don't know, life is too short to write on the same topic too much for me. I know that there are people who have material that they're going to chew on forever with great results, but I can't, I'm too easily bored.
Well, this story is set at a New Hampshire boarding school called Granby. And I know you live on the campus now of a boarding school that you attended as a young student.
Yeah.
And I also know this is a fictional story, but was this something that you thought you might write about for a while, seeing that this boarding school experience was and is such a part of your life?
Yeah, I always knew that someday there would be a boarding school novel. And I used to joke that I'd write it, you know, on my deathbed so that I didn't offend anybody. But, you know, this school is absolutely not the school that I know very well. It's not any school. I have a great time inventing things. I don't like to rely on real places and people. But the setup of a boarding school is so fascinating to me. The way that you have this, in some cases, really old, for America at least, permanent kind of place that is also fundamentally really transient. These people are passing through for 4 years at the most at this really formative time of their lives. And similarly, although it's very short for them, it's very foundational for them, it messes up time in an interesting way. And I'm always interested in how time gets messed up in the human experience. So it was always going to happen. And then, you know, I kind of stew on novel ideas for a long time before I begin. And this one had been percolating, marinating, whatever you want to call it, for several years. And then at a certain point, it was the most compelling thing in my head. It was the book I needed to write next.
In terms of the legal research, there's a lot about crimes being investigated, processed, understanding the ins and outs of the legal system, what can and does go wrong. What kind of research did you do specifically to prepare for this?
Yeah, I spoke early on to several different lawyers who could give me just the framework for, you know, what is possible. Basically, you know, the basic story of the novel is that my main character, Bodhi, comes to believe that the wrong man is in prison for the murder of one of her classmates in 1995. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer. I needed to talk, before I even began, I needed to talk to people just about, you know, how does a retrial come about? You know, what would need to happen for that to occur? And then as I got further on, a friend hooked me up with the most wonderful public defender in New Hampshire, who is married to a bookstore owner. It was like match made in heaven. And so she was able to talk to me a lot about, you know, how a defense would work, for instance, in New Hampshire, but also things like what's it like inside the New Hampshire State Prison for Men. And she was able to read the book a couple different times and was just a huge help. And then, you know, Reddit is always this amazing resource to go in and often you don't even have to ask the question because someone else has asked it. But people asking things like, you know, what happens if you're shivved in prison? And you like read through people's personal experiences of what that might be like. And, you know, not taking anyone's story directly, but it's as if you went out and interviewed a bunch of people. You have those details. You have that information.
Bodhi, the main character, has a successful podcast and she accepts this temporary teaching position at her former school. She returns to teach two classes. And while she's sort of struggling with her perceptions of her own classmates and teachers, it forces her to ask these questions and, like you said, reinvestigate or rethink this murder of her classmate. Is the idea of questioning something that you like to consider as an author and a reader?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, something I'm always telling my students is that your job as an author is not to solve problems and it's not to give answers. It's to take the questions you already had and complicate them. Like dig in and pull out all those threads, you know. You can imagine it's that thing where you go in and you're trying to untangle a necklace or a ball of yarn and you get your fingers in there and then you actually just make it worse. That's your job as a writer is, you know, and ultimately, though, you know, you're maybe loosening things up to the point that a reader can come to their own conclusions, their own revelations, or their own further questions. But you're not going in with a hypothesis or thinking that you know. You go in because you have a question you can't solve. And the only way that certain questions can be solved is narrative. That's why we dream. I mean, it's probably an actual brain doctor would say that's not actually why we dream. But to me, that's why we dream, right? Is that it's why we dream in narrative, that we have these problems that are so sticky that we can't logically work them out. So what we need is narrative to maybe make things more extreme, to you know, dreams sometimes do complicate things. We're like, why did I dream that I shared a toothbrush with my boss? That's messed up. But then you wake up having felt like you maybe worked something out. And that's what fiction should do for the author. And then hopefully the reader has a similar experience coming into it rather than being lectured to, for instance.
When you spoke on Late Night about The Great Believers, you talked about the amount of research you did to ensure that the world that you set this in Chicago in the 80s, all the way down to, I think I remember you talking about Google mapping parts of the city of Chicago.
Oh, constantly. Yeah. Yeah. Like policing.
Like storefronts and.
Right. Getting like 1986 gay bars mapped out, basically.
Right.
So that I could do like a fake walking tour of 1986 gay bars that are no longer there. Yeah.
The world of Granby, even though fictional, is so detailed and mapped out in a specific way. Like, I felt like I knew where the pool was and I knew where the dorms were and where Bodie's friends lived. Were you using similar techniques in building that world?
Well, in this case, I could invent it completely. So, you know, the maps were hand-drawn, very badly hand-drawn, you know, on the backs of old bills or whatever. And, you know, I was not picturing any specific campus. I really was inventing it. And there's tremendous joy in that invention, just getting to build this thing like you would want to do when you were 7 years old, you know, like I'm going to build this imaginary land. And yeah, it was important to me, for one thing, just to get oriented, to know where things were. It was also, I needed to write down like distances between places. Mm-hmm. And be very clear on those so I didn't contradict myself. And then recently, this is really fun, the marketing department at Penguin asked if I had a map. And I was like, yeah, it's really bad, though. They were like, don't worry, we're going to put the art department on it. So I sent in, I kind of redid, you know, my bad hand-drawn map, and I labeled things. And then they had this artist do this beautiful, I don't know if it's watercolor or gouache version with everything labeled. And they're sending it out with like some early copies to certain people, but I think it'll be online too. So by the time this airs, it should be linked on my website at the very least. And I'm like in love with this map. It's so beautiful.
That is very cool. You do examine a number of topics within the larger story here. There's this murder of a classmate, but there's this need for belonging and community. There's the kinds of stories and crimes that get national attention. There's the genre of true crime podcasts. There's power dynamics between teachers and students, men and women. But there's also this theme that you continue to return to, which is violence against women. And I'd love if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that there's sort of a motif, I guess I would call it, in the book, where there are these sort of litanies of cases that are on my character's mind, these other cases of violence against women. And the way that strain of the book came about was that I really wanted there to be something on the news that really captured Bodie's attention and threw her off balance, the way that a certain news stories just kind of take over our imaginations or take over our weeks. But I was really stuck because I didn't want to write about a very specific and real thing. I didn't want it to be like, you know, the Christine Blasey Ford testimony and then have to write about that in a way that might, you know, kind of take over the book. And I also didn't want to invent some case that was going on that, you know, people would have to invest more energy in following the details of that case. So the decision I made was, I'm not going to tell you what it is that's in the news. It's everything. So we go through her kind of contradicting herself and saying, you know, it was the one where the senator did this. No, wait, it was actually the one where the high school senior did this. And all of those things coexist. And then, you know, there are several sections written like that where this case comes back on TV or people are talking about it and they're saying all these things that contradict each other because it is all these cases at once. It was basically the solution to a problem that I had narratively, but that's the reason you try it out. You only keep things then if they work. And the reason that it worked for me was that it was this kind of sense of overwhelm, this sense of, God, there's always one of these going on. There's always something. And, you know, in her case, it's violence against women. You could do the same thing, certainly, with, say, police brutality. You could do the same thing with mass shootings, that there's just always that thing. There's always a new one. There are certain ones that capture your imagination and you think about all the time, and there are others that it's just this sea of noise that contributes to a feeling of you don't feel safe. You feel this kind of simmering sense of outrage, too.
Yes, I think it was alarming when you speak about the litany. It was alarming how many, even though they're not specific, how many I knew or thought I knew in terms of what they were and how many there were that came up.
Yeah. It's interesting. A lot of the ones she mentions are real, but a lot of them I actually made up also. Mm-hmm. It's just that felt right to me that it's this, you know, I could kind of make some what seemed like maybe outrageous ones, but they're no more outrageous than the ones that actually happened.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, I think someone could drive themselves nuts trying to figure out what every last one is because some of them don't actually exist. But there are definitely ones that reference real cases.
Yeah, I think that also sort of speaks to how you played with time in a way, just like the perception of what has happened or what we think we remember happening and what actually happened, because so much of that is just your own experience.
Yeah. It's, you know, I'm very interested in perception. And it's funny, I've had several interviewers talk to me about Bodhi as an unreliable narrator. And I actually don't agree. I think she is one of the most reliable narrators you're ever going to find because she is completely honest about not remembering things clearly. You know, that a lot of fiction, you have this sort of suspension of disbelief going in as a reader that someone remembers something and now here comes their memory and it is in great detail. Like, I smelled the air and it smelled like almonds. And then it's also completely chronological from start to finish, everything that happened and everything anyone said. Memory doesn't work that way. And I'm, of course, as a reader, I'm happy to, you know, just go, yeah, whatever. But as a writer for this book, I really wanted to work with the way that memory actually functions. It is completely, subjective. We can't trust it. It changes over time. And I wanted my narrator to be fundamentally trapped in the present. The book does, she remembers things. She talks about this, you know, this happened. I remember because, you know, I remember what this person said because they never swore, but this time they swore. She tells us why she remembers what she remembers, but we never jump back to 1995. The narrative never actually takes us there. And that was really important to me. I could have written a book that did, but I wanted us to be trapped in the present and at the mercy of memory.
That's interesting that you say that, because I also felt like there was I don't want to give anything away towards the end of the book, but there's an interaction that Bodhi has with a classmate who she perceived to be a different or have a different experience. Her perception of this other student's experience was so wildly different than what it actually was.
Right.
And I found her to be the most reliable in that moment, because when the woman comes back to her with her real experience, instead of saying, no, or being antagonistic in a way, she's so empathetic and understanding that her memory of what happened was not the actual experience for this other woman, and just saying, I'm sorry and thank you and those types of things. And I thought that was a really emotionally mature way to deal with something that you had no idea about.
Yeah, I think it's something that social media weirdly has given us. Is the ability to be back in touch with classmates who we might not actually have been friends with at the time. And, you know, for better or worse, right? Because I know I'm sure there's people have had negative experiences with that as well. But, you know, there are the people that I was already going to stay in touch with, that I stayed in touch with in the gap between college and Facebook coming into my life, right? And there are people who you might have gotten back in touch with at a reunion. You saw them every 5 years, if they're there, you know, and you connect. But certain people that I really thought they were different, or I didn't appreciate them, or they didn't appreciate me. We never spent time together. That we've discovered over social media, maybe it's just the way that our lives have gone, or maybe back then we would have been great friends, that we had a lot more in common. You also are able to see the way people change. You know, I'm not stuck with the idea of who someone was at 17, because I know now that this person is a parent, or, you know, a doctor, or in a couple cases, one from high school, one from college, a priest. Neither case was someone I ever would have predicted, right? And so you have this new vision of them, right, that who they are now. You know, that vibe was something that I wanted to bring into the book. Interestingly, Bodhi, my character, is not very much, she gets involved in some Twitter drama, but she's not in touch on Facebook with all of her old classmates. So she has this kind of later reconciling, you know, between what she thought people were and what they actually are. And in some cases, the things that you could not get from social media. So this one person she's talking to is opening up in a way that she could not have gotten just by staying in touch with her.
Right, right. Well, I really enjoyed the book so much, and I hope that all of our listeners will read. I have some questions for you, as well as your other novels, if they haven't already. One last question.
Yeah.
Are there any books you'd like to recommend for our audience today?
Yes. We have another hour, right? I can keep going. So I'm doing this project right now. My father passed away in early 2020, and we weren't able to have a memorial. And he was, among other things, a literary translator. So I'm doing this project where I'm reading my way around the world in translation. And I'm going to do 84 books because he lived to be 84. And I started in Hungary. I just finished Greece. I'm about to read a Turkish novel next. And I'm going to end in Hungary as well. And I'm, you know, tweeting about it. I'm doing my Substack about it. I've got people like joining me if I can convince anyone out there to read in translation. But the book that I started with was the novel The Door by Magda Szabo, S-Z-A-B-O. It's a Hungarian novel from the, I can't remember, 70s or 80s. God, it is stunning. People have been asking me for years whether I'd read it because they know I'm Hungarian and it's one of the few Hungarian novels popularly in English translation, and I hadn't. And God, it is so good. It's about the relationship between a woman and her cleaning woman. And things go very dark. It's really intense. It's beautiful. And I hope absolutely everyone will read it.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss, but that sounds like such a wonderful way to pay tribute to him.
Thank you. It's been fun. It's been good. Yeah.
And thank you so much for chatting today. It was great to see you again, even though it was virtual. And
yeah.
We're really appreciative you took the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
After the break, we're joined by Nick Higgins, Chief Librarian at the Brooklyn Public Library. Nick Higgins is the Chief Librarian at the Brooklyn Public Library, and he and his team were recently named Librarians of the Year by Library Journal for the creation of the Books Unbanned program. Nick speaks to us about the genesis of Books Unbanned and how it came as a response to the alarming and growing efforts to censor what students are reading. He also talks to us about the young people he relied upon to help refine the program and how the literary community, from librarians to students and teachers, has responded to the initiative. Now here's my conversation with Nick. Nick Higgins, thanks for being here and welcome to Late Night Lit.
Hey, thanks, Sarah. Good to be here with you.
So you are the Chief Librarian of the Brooklyn Public Library here in New York.
That's right.
I am curious to hear about the Books Unbanned program, which is an incredible initiative that came out of a real need, but I was hoping we could start with a little bit of your background.
Yeah, sure. Listen, I've been in New York City for a little over 23 years. I started in libraries about 17 years ago as a librarian trainee here in Brooklyn. And that meant that I was afforded an opportunity to rotate to different branches in the public library system. And here in Brooklyn, we have 61 libraries spread across every neighborhood in the city. So I was able to see a lot of different needs from different neighborhoods. I, you know, not only learned a whole hell of a lot about libraries, but also about this city that I call home. You know, in places that I had never, you know, thought of going before, different neighborhoods that I had heard about but never had an opportunity to go to. I was actually embedded in them. And, you know, from there, just, you know, worked my way, you know, through different roles in the library, including being the jail and prison library supervisor for some years, you know, building an outreach services department, you know, building services for immigrants, people experiencing homelessness, older adults. And where I'm at right now is chief librarian, which means that I get to oversee all of that.
Well, that's amazing because it sounds like you have experience with outreach to communities or groups of people in need in many different capacities.
Absolutely. And finding out where the library, a community-based library, could intervene in people's lives where they need the most help and assistance. And determining how flexible the role of a librarian can be and should be.
What was your initial path to being drawn to libraries or literature?
Always loved books. If I, you know, go back to it, I mean, I grew up in different places in the upper Midwest. We moved around a lot when I was a kid. And my own sort of like public library origin story was when every new town that we got to, one of the first stops, you know, my parents would take me to a public library, get a little library card, you know, and I put it in my, you know, red kind of Velcro wallet and, you know, have a big collection of these library cards. But, you know, one, I think it was for, you know, my parents, they needed a little bit of daycare for me and my brothers and sisters. And, you know, we could just go in there and not be bothered and we could read whatever we wanted to. And another thing, it just really, like, I was really, you know, drawn to these spaces where I didn't have to perform. I didn't have to be anyone I wasn't, you know, didn't feel like being. And there were people around me, adults who, you know, if I asked for help, you know, they give it to me, but they weren't, you know, it wasn't like school. They weren't telling me what I needed to read or what to do. And that's where it came from. And, you know, from then I just, you know, continued to have my nose in a book, you know, throughout my, you know, childhood and into, you know, into adulthood. And, you know, I think that was what drew me to libraries initially. But once I got in public libraries, particularly here in Brooklyn, it became all about, you know, the myriad other needs that people come through the doors with and, you know, sort of how flexible, again, a librarian's role can be.
Yeah, absolutely. So just for our listeners, a little bit of background here. My digital producer, Jay, read an article in the New York Times about the Books Unbanned initiative, which featured you and your fellow librarians as Librarians of the Year for the initiative that you started about a year ago, I think.
Yeah, back in April.
Can you explain both what the program is and also where the need for it grew out of?
For sure. Yeah. So back at the, you know, start of 2022, like, and we were, you know, paying attention to different stories that were coming up in the press about book bans that were, and challenges that were happening across the country and, you know, in communities across the country. And, you know, we were kind of, you know, starting to kick the tires on different ideas about how we could intervene in people's lives who were in communities that didn't have the kind of support around them to protect a reader's interests or protect the freedom to read. And we just saw this trend that, you know, some of the attacks and some of the censorship efforts were getting a lot more coordinated, the language being used to, you know, challenge books in school board meetings and in public libraries was starting to sound much more similar. And we thought that, you know, as a large library system, perhaps there's something that we could do and help others, you know, other libraries and other, you know, community members coordinate their efforts to push back. We're a public library and, you know, we make book displays, we, you know, recommend books, we leverage voices of authors that are challenged, we try to showcase some of the work that's, you know, being pulled off of shelves in other communities. And we'll still do that. And we think that's really important. And it takes a lot of work. But we really wanted to figure out how we could go beyond the walls of our own library here in Brooklyn, beyond our borders, and help someone in like Collierville, Tennessee, you know, a student who is walking into their school library and, you know, seeing their story, the one that they identify with, being taken from the shelf and hidden from public view. So, you know, we just started talking about, well, maybe we can just, you know, give everyone in the state of Texas, for instance, a Brooklyn Public Library card. And then everyone in Texas who is facing challenges in their communities for the books that they read or want to read, they can just access our library system, our digital ebooks and audiobooks collection. And from there, it just sort of evolved. I mean, it took a little work to figure out how that could be possible. We narrowed our focus, or maybe expanded our focus, to say that any young person in the country, age 13 to 21, can write to us, send us an email, or send us a, you know, TikTok video, or you know, direct message us on Twitter, and tell us what kind of challenges they're facing in their own communities. You know, why libraries are important, why they love to read, why they think, you know, freedom to read is an important value to protect and a right to protect. And we would issue them for free a Brooklyn Public Library, what we call an e-card. And then they would have unfettered access to 500,000 ebooks and audiobooks from the Brooklyn Public Library collection. You know, that's banned books and books, just regular books that aren't banned, that aren't being challenged. They can read whatever they want. And so we decided we were just going to do that. And we launched it in April of 2022. And, you know, really, you know, put teens at the center and, you know, asked their advice along the way and got their guidance on how to develop the program. And that's what we did.
That's amazing. I'd love to hear a little bit more about the process and hearing from students or young readers. You mentioned like sending a video, and I'm sure they're telling you their stories in emails and DMs.
Yeah.
Have you found they're sharing the initiative with other students? And how have you found that amongst this group of people that you've reached, that they are spreading the word to others?
Yeah. So we get, first of all, like the messages that we get, we've received thousands of emails and direct messages. Since April, we've issued over 6,000 library cards to young people in all 50 states, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico. And, you know, the messages, the stories that they tell range from, I'm afraid, I see books that, you know, that focus on, you know, my own gender identity being attacked in my community. And I feel attacked, and I just need some support. And I really need to read the books that I want to read, to, you know, kids who live in rural areas, who the nearest public library might be, you know, an hour's drive away and they can't get to it. So there's access issues more broadly. And, you know, the point of, you know, connecting, you know, teens with their own peers, you know, we were very careful at the beginning, again, to take the guidance and the leadership from the teens themselves. So there are teens here at Brooklyn Public Library who are involved in a bunch of different internship programs and other library activities. And we asked them at the very beginning before we launched, like, A, is this a good idea? Should we be doing this? And, you know, how much do you know about this issue? You're in Brooklyn, so maybe books like censorship isn't really like a top line issue for you. So the teens themselves, being curious and sort of motivated, they formed into what they call a Teen Intellectual Freedom Council. And so they've been meeting like once a month virtually. And as we've been issuing library cards to teens across the United States, teens from across the United States are now joining into that council. So we have teens from all over the place talking with Brooklyn teens, and they're sharing stories about, you know, what people are, again, facing in, you know, a small town in Vermont or out in Idaho or Texas, and, you know, discussing ways that, you know, people can, again, stand up for their rights in their own communities, what resources are available. And they're also like talking about what books they like to read.
That's so cool.
So they are like spreading the word among themselves. And like, it's a peer group that has, you know, is very well connected to one another and very eager to learn more.
That's amazing. Have you found that there are specific books or authors or perhaps genres that you find right now are being more frequently requested?
From those e-cards that we've issued, around 6,000 e-cards, I mean, it runs the gamut. I mean, there are, you know, folks who are looking for books that are, you know, largely banned. And oftentimes, like we, you know, we found over the last few years that the book bans are really focusing in on, you know, Black authors, LGBTQ plus authors, writers, narrative stories, protagonists. And so it seems like it's a different kind of book ban happening. So it's really targeting sort of people themselves. So some of those books are being requested. So Maya Kobe Babe's Genderqueer is being requested. You know, you've got Angie Thomas books, and, you know, Nicole Hannah Jones' 1619 Project is being requested. But largely, like, they're reading, you know, other things too. So they look at this collection of 500,000 ebooks and audiobooks, and they're really browsing. They're reading, you know, history books, and they're reading romance novels, and they're, you know, they're reading like classic fiction and everything. So it's sort of what you'd expect a sort of a general library user would be checking out. So there's really, you know, really no strong trends other than people are indeed reading what they, you know, they find interesting and are taking advantage of the big collection that we have here at the library.
Well, you noted that these book bans tend to target titles by or about minorities and LGBTQ plus individuals. I think this has been widely exposed in the press in certain capacities about what happens to young readers when they lose access, not the least of which is representation. But what do you see as the most prominent and dangerous to young readers who are not allowed access to certain literature?
You know, I think that we traditionally in libraries will push back, you know, on censorship efforts or challenges by saying that, you know, to live well and, you know, healthily in a, you know, pluralistic society that we all aspire to here in this country, we need to be exposed to different points of view to be able to understand one another, to develop a sense of empathy, to, you know, understand, you know, how to work together to build the communities and society that we want. And I think that's still true. But here, I think it's, again, a little bit different. I think what, you know, this is certainly about banning books and challenging books and particular titles. But it's also disingenuous to say that that's all it's about. I think the undercurrent of all of this, like you said, and like I mentioned before, you know, the books that are being targeted are written by, you know, Black authors and LGBTQ plus communities, and they're being singled out. And it's also being kind of mirrored in, you know, House bills in certain states that mirror some of this language about not being exposed to critical race theory or, you know, ideas about, you know, gender and sexuality and that sort of thing. So it is sort of a concerted effort to target certain people. So it's, you know, you're a teenager. It's hard enough to be a teenager. If you remember, it's awkward. You're trying on new identities. You're trying to figure out how you will move through the earth and through life. And you walk into one of the places that you may find, you know, some comfort, and you're welcome in this space, this public library where, you know, you're left alone. You can read whatever you want. And even in that space, you walk through the doors and you find that ostensibly responsible adults are choosing books that speak to you and removing them from the public view, from the public discourse. And what that says to a young person, a teenager especially, is that you have no business belonging in this community. So it really is not only about removing books, but it's, you know, removing the right for, you know, certain people in a community to live freely in that community.
Yeah, and I think that's well said. And just the policing of education or opportunity in a way where those certain individuals, who gets to decide what gets to be read?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and something that gets lost here as well. Librarians and teachers, you know, are being criminalized for doing their jobs, for being the professionals that they worked so hard to become. And the power to make those decisions about what should be like a teacher's decision about curriculum or a librarian's decision about collection development is being concentrated at the state level or in certain centers of power and being taken away from the individuals whose job it is to actually, you know, do those things. And they're being criminalized for it. And so I worry about that as much as I do about the young people who are facing these challenges. It's the professionals who, you know, are demoralized and targeted themselves and being shouted down at school board meetings and being attacked at the reference desk. We need to figure out a way to step in, intervene, be good bystanders and be good partners with those folks and provide a level of protection and support.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And so well said, and you're certainly doing your part to help that along. I'd love to close with just if there's a book you'd like to recommend, either banned or unbanned, that you think our listeners should check out?
Oh, I mean, listen, I read a ton. I'll just recommend the book that I'm reading right now, and it's already been out for a year or so, but I'm finally getting around to it. And Kim Stanley Robinson is a wonderful writer. I'm reading The Ministry for the Future, and it's all about a different kind of crisis that we're facing right now. And that's basically the climate change and, you know, how we've been ignoring the issue for so long. And it not only talks about expertly, I think, the systems that were put in place to ostensibly, again, sort of like mitigate the effects of climate change, but in fact are actually exacerbating it, all the way down to the business end of ignoring the urgency of the climate crisis to the people who are living in communities all across the globe. It's remarkable. It's a remarkable book, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Well, thank you again for joining us today, Nick, and congratulations to you and your team at the Brooklyn Public Library on the great work you've done on behalf of readers, especially young readers everywhere.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I appreciate the attention to this and interest, and enjoy your show. Thanks.
This month, we asked Late Night staffer Kristen Milburn to share a book she recommends for your next read.
Hi. My name is Kristen Milburn, and I'm the receptionist at Late Night with Seth Meyers. I love young adult fiction, so I'd like to recommend one of my very favorites, I'll Give You the Sun by Jandy Nelson. It follows Jude and Noah, twins who were once inseparable but now barely talk, as they struggle through their early teens and work to overcome grief, discover their sexualities, and figure out who they are after they lost each other along the way. Both talented artists, Jude and Noah alternate narrating the story, with Noah's chapters focusing on when they are 13 and still on speaking terms, and Jude's chapters focusing on when they are 16 after their relationship has deteriorated. I'm not usually drawn to books that alternate narrators because, let's be honest, I always end up more invested in one perspective over the other, but I loved it here. Juxtaposing their unreliable teenager narration makes it harder to wade through what actually happened and who is in the wrong, but that's the point, because there isn't really a clear-cut answer. The nonlinear narration mirrors the confusion and contention that the characters feel, and I love discovering the story through both of them equally. I'll Give You the Sun is also just plain beautifully written. Noah, a painter, will interject his narration with the parentheses just for the reader, creating and naming a painting that would fit what he's feeling. For example, when he begins falling in love, he notes, "Self-portrait, two boys racing into brightness." It's only a few words, so it doesn't feel distracting or heavy-handed, but does so much to reveal who Noah is and what he's thinking. Sometimes the portraits corroborate what he's telling other characters, and sometimes they reveal what he's really thinking and not telling them, but all of them are stunning, smart, and unlike anything else I've come across. I first read it at a time when I really needed it, but I'll Give You the Sun is earnest, heartfelt, and unique, so I've continued to love it ever since. And with that, my current self-portrait would be called I'll Give You a Recommendation. Let me know what you think.
This has been Late Night Lit. My thanks to Seth Meyers, Mike Shoemaker, Rebecca Mackay, Nick Higgins, Kristen Milburn, Matt Ryman, Jay Johnson, Ross Leupold, and Rafaela Huelos. Our theme music was written and performed by the 8G Band. For Late Night with Seth Meyers, I'm Sarah Jenks Daly. Thank you for listening and happy reading.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.